schon Bilal Barakat. Ich freue mich sehr, dass Sie zu uns gekommen sind. Sie haben eine Zeit lang ja auch schon in Wien gelebt, an der Akademie für Wissenschaften gearbeitet. Jetzt sind Sie bei der UNESCO beschäftigt, sind da zuständig für den Global Global Education Monitoring Report, der immer wieder herauskommt mit unterschiedlichen Schwerpunkten. Sie werden uns über diesen Report berichten, wir werden erfahren, worum es geht, wie die Lage ist. Und ich freue mich, Sie begrüßen zu dürfen.
Ja, zunächst einmal vielen herzlichen Dank für die Einladung. Ich freue mich wirklich sehr, hier zu sein und für die Vorstellung. Ich werde auf Englisch vortragen. Es ist ein globaler Report. Die ganzen Materialien sind natürlich auf Englisch, aber ich nehme Fragen gerne auf Deutsch entgegen natürlich. So, I'm not here today to talk about the report as such, the Global Education Monitoring Report. The launch of the 2019 report happened just over a year ago. One of these launches was in Vienna. And the best way to get an idea of what the report is and what you can learn from it is actually to take one. There are copies outside. There's a German, I think there are a few copies of the German summary also. But I will talk a bit about the report and how it fits into the picture and what we can learn from it as I go along. Okay. So one of the reasons we're here today is because education is no longer just a national policy issue. Right? Education policy happens at various levels. We have obviously still the national level, and in many cases subnational education policy making, not just in federal states. But we also have a regional level. The African Union, for example, has its own sort of development strategy, including an education component. The EU, of course, had its 2020 sort of education strategy and a follow-up to that. And at the global level, we have the SDG 4 framework for education. Now, partly as a result of this increasing activity sort of at regional and global level, we have more and more actors in the education landscape, in the global education landscape. And not only do we have more actors, we also have a blurring of the boundaries to some extent. So if we're thinking of funding globally for education, it used to be the case that a lot of development aid for education came through bilateral funding from national development agencies directly to recipients, to projects. More and more, we have multilateral funding platforms and funds, such as the Global Partnership for Education, the Education Cannot Wait Fund, focusing on conflict-affected countries that we heard about. We have new blended financing instruments that try to combine sort of national donor contributions with private sector loans and involvement. We have a broadening of the mandates of different agencies. So the World Bank is no longer just a development bank that provides loans to implement projects. Long ago, it moved from just infrastructure projects also to sort of social investments, including education. Along with that came policy advice on how to invest that money. Right? But more and more, the World Bank, for example, sees itself as a knowledge broker, right? As a research institution. If you look at rankings of economics departments by sort of output in terms of research articles, the World Bank actually competes sort of with some of the top universities in the world in terms of how much research is being done. If you look at UNESCO and UNICEF, it's no longer the case that it's clear that UNESCO has the mandate for education and UNICEF looks at child protection, right? And just for literally children under the age of 18. UNICEF is doing a lot more education work, also involving the families and realizing that you can't talk just about the children without talking about the mothers and the mothers' education. Good. So the architecture, the global education architecture, is becoming more complex, and I'll get back to some of the implications of that later on. Right? The complexity also affects the monitoring. So it's not quite true that when you think of the Millennium Development Goals that ran from 2000 to 2015, it's not quite true that those education goals were made up by a group of people sitting in an office in New York. Right? But compared to the SDGs, which explicitly was a much more inclusive process involving discussions between civil society, country representatives, different UN agencies, you don't really have to fully take in what's shown here, but this is just the monitoring and reporting framework for the SDGs generally in the left column, and SDG 4 specifically in the right column. Right? So for SDG 4, we have 43 indicators. We have 11 indicators that belong to the SDG agenda generally. On top of that, the education community added another 32 so-called thematic indicators on education through a process where a technical cooperation group with representatives from member states, from UN agencies, looks at different proposals, discusses methodological changes, submits these changes for review to statistical agencies. Those are approved by a broader forum, the Interagency and Expert Group. And the reason I'm showing you this is to show you that there's a process and there are mandates and it's supposed to be an inclusive process. And as I said, I'll get back to some of the implications of that. The Global Education Monitoring Report specifically sort of falls in that right column. So we have the mandate from the global education community to report on the progress towards SDG 4 globally. This was already the case under the Education for All and MDG agenda. So almost every year, there's a report looking at progress around the world on the indicators and also on one particular theme. So the kickoff to the new series, the SDG series of the report, was on education and the SDGs, sort of to set a baseline. We've had a report on focusing on the theme of accountability, last year's report on migration and displacement and education, that's the one you find outside. We are currently working on a report on inclusion and inclusive education, and the one after that will be on the role of non-state actors in education, not just private schools, but the whole range. Private foundations, funding education, technology companies, and so on. Now, I talked a bit about the architecture, but the key message behind all this is that the world is not on track for SDG 4, not even close. If we look at the key goals of even just primary school completion, never mind secondary school completion, at current trends, it will still not be the case that every child completes primary school in 2030. We need a real transformational, radical change in the kinds of trends and trajectories that we see. We haven't seen that so far. The SDG 4 adoption by itself hasn't created that momentum. There are a couple of things that need to happen for that to actually still occur. We need to look at inequality much more carefully, not just at the averages. We have to look much more carefully, not just at access of children, not just getting them into school, but what happens when they're in school and what it is they're learning. there's a lot of focus on learning the basics, because as we'll see, even the basics are still not there, but all the things beyond the basics can't wait, right? We still have to think about what do we want today's young people to actually do with the knowledge they're learning? How are they going to apply that? How are they going to transform their lives and society also to achieve all the other SDG goals? That can't just happen in school. We have to think much more systematically about lifelong learning. We've been talking about lifelong learning for a long time, right? But at the international level, in terms of what's actually happening, what's actually being monitored, it still doesn't get anywhere near as much attention. We have to look beyond education generally. We have to look at other sectors. Links with health are very obvious, but also with many other sectors. And we really have to try and use the regional and international fora and cooperation more effectively. So just how off track are we? So even just looking at something really elementary like primary school completion, there was actually a lot of progress during the 2000s, purely in terms of getting children into primary school, but that has effectively stalled since around 2010 or so. And it doesn't matter whether you look at completion or whether you look at how many children reach the final grade. It's the same story. There was stagnation. Something happened. We really had some progress, and now it's stalled again, well below 100%. So the SDG 4 goal calls for universal secondary school completion by 2030. That's a tall order. If you think about the children who graduate secondary school in 2030, they're supposed to have started school now, or last year even. Now, we know that not all children started school last year who were supposed to. So we're already behind on the 2030 goal for secondary schooling. Globally, only around half of young people complete secondary school. And in low-income countries, it's not even one in five. Completing school isn't enough, right? We also expect children to actually learn something in school. A lot of children do not learn foundational, fundamental skills in reading and mathematics. But the real tragedy is that it's not that too many children aren't in school and therefore not learning, right? Most of the children who don't learn the fundamentals did actually go to school. So the majority, all the gray here, the blue, these are different world regions. The blue is the share of children who learn fundamental, who reach minimum learning goals. The red are the children who don't finish school and didn't learn the foundational skills. And all the gray in the middle, those are children who did go to school, who finished school and still didn't, primary school, and still didn't learn foundational skills. So you see, there's actually more gray than red. Most children who are not learning despite going to school. If we look at gender equality, at primary level, if you take the global average, you actually have approximately the same number of boys and girls in school, right? But if you look at any one country, right, only a minority of countries at secondary level actually has equal numbers of boys and girls in school. At upper secondary level, it's just a quarter of countries have equal numbers. Right? Gender is not the only dimension of disadvantage. In slums, for example, children have way lower probabilities of attending school, completing school, and so on. And there are numerous other groups we could think about. We heard about refugees. We heard about children with disabilities. Now, it's easy for you to believe that, you know, an indigenous refugee children with disabilities will have very low school completion rates. Right? But the thing is, you don't actually have to go that far. Right? So here, we're just looking at the intersection of male-female gender with urban-rural residents, and household wealth. So these are broad groups, right? If we're talking about poor rural women in Nigeria, we're talking millions or tens of millions of people, right? And here you have primary completion rate going up to 20%. Right? So each of these groups, the dark red dots are poor rural women in a given country, right? The dark red triangles are poor rural men, and so on. All of these groups have primary school completion rates below 20%. Right? So when we're talking about the furthest behind, right, and reaching the furthest behind first, we don't have to go searching. Right? We literally just looking at huge groups of people in many poor countries, such as poor women or rural women or even poor men. These groups already, in some cases, have primary school completion of less than 1 in 5. Now, the reasons for this are complex, but certainly one reason is insufficient investment. We did an analysis. If you look at the left panel first here, we did an analysis of estimating the total amount of money being spent on education globally, right, from public and private sources, right, and how that reaches or how that's spent in different countries. Okay. The interesting thing is that low-income countries and high-income countries have approximately the same number of school-aged children. Okay. Of all the money being spent on education in the world, 65% is spent in high-income countries. Okay. And now you'd wish this were the kind of graph where each bar sort of grows up and we're waiting for the left one to grow up, but that's it. So 0.5 of all the money being spent on education globally is spent on education in low-income countries. So it's not a big mystery of what's going on. And to add, to make things worse, if we look at the share of government spending and private spending, of how much of this spending comes from the state and how much comes from families, then the poorer the country, the more families have to spend. And that's the irony. So in low-income countries, families spend a bigger share of education expenditure, carry a bigger share of education expenditure than in rich countries. Circling back to the role of the global architecture in this, the LDCs are least developed countries. The blue line is low-income countries, and the orange is sub-Saharan Africa. This is the percentage of aid to basic education going to these regions. And so you see that less and less of global aid to basic education is going directly to sub-Saharan Africa. Less and less is going directly to least developed countries. And more is going to multilateral funding platforms. So these are, so some of this money obviously still then ends up in low-income countries and in sub-Saharan Africa, but you can see how things are getting more complex and the flows are less and less directly targeted at those most in need. Right? Now, I wish I could leave you with sort of a set of really simple take-home messages and solutions and answers to take home, but I think the track record of simple solutions isn't terribly good, right? Especially in this day and age. So instead, I'm going to leave you with a couple of dilemmas. So one dilemma is that clearly we need all the help we can get, right? We need everyone to pitch in. We need all hands on deck. That includes the private sector. Right? But at the same time, we want to maintain coherence and everyone working sort of in a coordinated fashion, and we also want to maintain accountability. Right? So all of all the scholarships going to sub-Saharan Africa for post-secondary study, 95% come from just two private of all corporate scholarships. Right? So all private scholarships to sub-Saharan Africa, 95% come from just two foundations. Right? And that's great, and it's great that they're giving these scholarships, but if they decide tomorrow to stop that, you know, where are we left? Where's the accountability? There are lots of discussions around the influence that big foundations have in setting the agenda in the health sector through large grants, and we have similar discussions in education. There's a real dilemma around pragmatism versus ambition. So we heard that one of the good things about the SDG 4 agenda is that it's for all the countries. To be relevant to all the countries, some of it is about higher education. Some of it is about very ambitious skills. There's a risk at the same time of concluding that this isn't really relevant. You know, we were looking at these countries where only half of children complete primary school, and why are we even talking about higher education? Right? Let's just focus on the basics. Let's just focus on elementary numeracy and literacy skills. But then we've been there before. Right? I can recognize a previous cycle in that. I'm sure Leon, Professor Tickley, can recognize sort of a full cycle or a cycle and a half. We've had this discussion about basic education before in the 1990s, right? Of saying, well, poor countries should just focus on basic education, don't worry about post-secondary, just try and get elementary literacy sorted. Right? But there are huge problems with that. Ultimately, you're saying that ambition and higher cognitive skills is something reserved for the privileged, right? And it sounds like you're saying that the poor should focus on basic skills. That's all they're going to need for the manual jobs they will have in the global labor market, right? There are huge problems with sort of limiting things that way. There's a dilemma around targeting versus inclusiveness. Should we really target? There's a need to target on those furthest behind, really very furthest behind. But at the same time, you know, just like with poverty, raising people above a dollar a day, those are the furthest behind. We should raise people out of a dollar a day poverty, but we can't forget about them once they earn $2 a day, right? So there's a real dilemma there around how do we invest our attention to those really very furthest behind who are not in school, not learning anything, and those who are slightly better off, but who are still nowhere near where they need to be. Right? So the World Bank recently, they came up with their own target. They decided that there's learning poverty, children who are not learning, they are learning poor, and the SDGs are too ambitious, and we should just try to cut learning poverty in half by 2030. Right? And this goes back to the pragmatism versus ambition. Yes, that's pragmatic, and maybe that's more achievable, but what about the other half? Right? If our aim is just to cut the number in half of children not learning, then it's tempting to focus on the ones we can get above the threshold easily, and the ones who have no chance will have to wait until later. There's a dilemma of uncertainty versus needing to act. Some of the countries with the worst education outcomes, we don't even have data. Right? So it's not true that the missing data is sort of average. Right? We know that the countries with no data are most likely even worse than the countries with data. About individual level, we know very, very little actually about the education of children with disabilities. Right? There's too little high quality data. At the same time, there are all these research outcomes of what's impactful. Do textbooks matter for learning? Do trained teachers matter for learning? Right? And a lot of the results are really ambiguous, or you know, there's no clear conclusions there. Right? But it would be wrong. I have yet to meet a researcher from the OECD who takes these findings that maybe textbooks don't matter, maybe trained teachers don't matter, maybe functioning toilets in schools don't matter. No one goes back home and then in their schools in the US or Germany or Austria start saying, you know, we shouldn't worry about functioning toilets, we shouldn't worry about textbooks, and we shouldn't worry about teachers, right? So the uncertainty around what works, the uncertainty around who exactly the furthest behind are, that can't stop us from taking action. Right? Just because we don't know exactly how and exactly which textbooks work, that's not an excuse not to spend money on textbooks and not to invest in trained teachers. I think I've run out of time very much. I'll leave it at that. I very much look forward to the discussion and taking your questions, and so thank you very much for your attention.